President Trump unleashed.
Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman's job at the White House is over, just 2 days after impeachment ended.
And now Gordon Sondland's days as ambassador to the EU. Done too. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro, and this is Up First from NPR News. During a debate in New Hampshire, fresh off a strong showing in Iowa, Pete Buttigieg on the offensive.
If you don't go all the way to the edge, it doesn't count. Politics, it says it's my way or the highway.
Are you talking about Senator Sanders?
Yes.
An outcry within China after a Wuhan doctor dies from the coronavirus.
He'd used social media to warn about the disease, and then authorities reprimanded him.
Now angry citizens are online, and the Chinese government is responding. Stay with us. We'll give you the news you need to start your day.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Salesforce, a customer relationship management solution committed to helping you deliver the personalized experiences that customers want. Salesforce, bringing companies and customers together. Visit salesforce.com/learn more.
Well, I'm not happy with him. You think I'm supposed to be happy with him? I'm not.
And within hours of those comments by President Trump on the South Lawn yesterday, security officers escorted Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman out of the White House. His twin brother, also on the national security staff, was escorted out at the same time.
Then it was Gordon Sondland's turn. No escort for him, though. Sondland did issue a statement thanking the president for the opportunity to serve as ambassador to the European Union.
Both Vindman and Sondland provided damaging testimony about the president's pressure campaign on Ukraine last fall during the impeachment inquiry. We're joined now by NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Franco, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Remind us, please, how damaging was Lieutenant Colonel's testimony before the House Intelligence Committee?
Well, Vindman oversaw American policy toward Ukraine on the National Security Council. He listened in on President Trump's July 25th call with Ukraine President Volodymyr Zelensky. He said he had no doubt that Trump was demanding that Ukraine investigate former Vice President Joe Biden in return for an Oval Office visit. And, you know, being there testifying in his dress uniform, he struck quite a figure on television.
And Ambassador Sondland.
Well, Sondland was one of the, quote, three amigos who worked with Rudy Giuliani, the president's lawyer, on Ukraine policy outside the normal foreign policy channels.
Was there a quid pro quo? As I testified previously, with regard to the requested White House call and the White House meeting, the answer is yes.
He famously said, everyone was in the loop. But his comments were also used by Republicans to defend Trump. Sondland said at one point that Trump told him that he wanted nothing from Ukraine. No quid pro quo.
Franco, is this retaliation? I mean, the president of the United States made personnel changes.
Yeah, I mean, we saw President Trump celebrating his acquittal this week. He was clearly angry and even spoke about Vindman and his brother with disdain. I asked John Gans about this. He wrote a book on the NSC called White House Warriors. He said it's clear Trump knew people were watching, but now feels, as you know, you noted earlier, unleashed by the acquittal and wanted these three people gone.
Serve at the pleasure of the president. So that is something that they all knew going into these jobs. But it is still shocking to see sort of personal animus and personal retribution playing out, as it appears to be with these three public servants.
It's not a surprise that Democratic leaders like House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senator Chuck Schumer are outraged. They're calling this shameful and Trump weak.
And what about the other career civil servants who testified in the inquiry? Do they still have jobs?
Well, there have been a flood of people who already left. They include U.S. ambassadors who worked in Ukraine, such as Marie Yovanovitch and William Taylor. But there are still seven career officials who are still in their jobs. My colleagues and I reached out to their attorneys last night, and as of now, no changes to report just yet.
NPR's White House correspondent Franco Ordonez. Franco, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And to Manchester, New Hampshire, where Democrats met on stage last night to debate.
Seven candidates: Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Amy Klobuchar, Tom Steyer, and Andrew Yang.
But the focus was on Bernie, Buttigieg, and Biden, the three Bs. Sanders and Buttigieg, the two top finishers in Iowa, and Biden, the national frontrunner, whose Iowa caucus showing was fourth. NPR's Scott Detrow is in New Hampshire and joins us now. Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
All right. Former Vice President Joe Biden, fourth in Iowa. He was probably feeling, I imagine, some pressure coming onto this debate. He had a lot to prove. What did you see on stage last night?
That he definitely feels that pressure. His goal for every debate up until now was to stand there and not make any news. And he had a way different approach last night. Right off the bat, very first answer, he criticized both Bernie Sanders and Pete Buttigieg, the two candidates who essentially tied in Iowa, starting with the fact that Bernie Sanders labels himself a Democratic Socialist.
I think that's the label that the president's going to lay on everyone running with Bernie if he's a nominee. And Mayor Buttigieg is a great guy and a real patriot. He's a mayor of a small city who has done some good things, but has not demonstrated he has the ability to, and we'll soon find out, to get a broad scope of support across the spectrum, including African-Americans and Latinos.
Biden mixed it up all night. It's clear that his above-the-fray approach suddenly does not work when he's finishing in fourth place. But he also said something very notable in that first answer, that he may do poorly in New Hampshire as well. And that is just a remarkable thing to say when you are the candidate basing so much of your pitch around the fact that you're the most electable.
Well, let's talk about former South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, who did well in Iowa, to the surprise of many. How much more scrutiny did he get last night?
Pretty decent amount. He got the front-runner treatment. Questions from moderators and other candidates about his experience, about his track record. And despite the fact that the current president has a reality TV background, the fact that it's extraordinary that this mayor of a city of about 100,000 is among the front-runners for the presidential nomination. So questions on the fact of, does he have enough experience? Buttigieg was criticized by Elizabeth Warren and others for how South Bend's police force treated African-Americans. There was a disproportionate arrest rate on drug charges for African-Americans compared to white people. He was also questioned about foreign policy, but that's an area where Buttigieg seemed very comfortable, repeatedly drawing on his time serving in Afghanistan. One moment stood out to me when moderator David Muir repeatedly pressed Buttigieg on whether or not he would have ordered a strike on Iranian General Qasem Soleimani like President Trump did.
I'm asking, if your national security team came to you and presented you with the opportunity, would you take the strike?
It depends on the circumstances. It depends if there was an alternative, and it depends what the different effects would be. That's my point. This is not an episode of 24. This is a situation that requires that you actually evaluate the entire intelligence picture.
All right, let's note that the other top performer in Iowa, Bernie Sanders, was also criticized for voting against gun control measures in the 1990s. He said he was representing a rural state and has changed his mind and has always supported an assault weapons ban. Scott, with 3 days left to campaign in New Hampshire, what are you looking for?
I guess I would start with New Hampshire's ability to count votes on Tuesday night compared to Iowa. So we'll start there. Does another candidate force himself or herself into the conversation? Or does the result in New Hampshire amplify Iowa and make this continue to be focused on Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders? Does Joe Biden rebound? If he does have another poor finish, as he seems to be suggesting he might, what happens next? Does he start to fade before he gets to South Carolina, where he thinks he's the strongest? Also, turnout. Iowa's caucus turnout was about flat from 2016.
Yeah.
Repeating 2016 is not any Democrats' plan to win this presidential election. No, and we do know over the course of a long primary season, turnout numbers do give us a pretty good sense of how energized or not energized a party's base is.
That's NPR's Scott Detrow in New Hampshire. Thank you so much.
Sure thing.
And for more on the campaign, be sure to check out the NPR Politics podcast. The death of a Chinese doctor this week has sent China into mourning.
Dr. Li Wenliang tried to warn other medical staff about the coronavirus last December. He was reprimanded by police for spreading rumors, and then he contracted the disease himself a few weeks ago. Now, tens of millions of people in China are posting online tributes to him, many using this song.
Do you hear the people sing, singing the song of angry men? It is the music of a people who will not be slaves again.
It's Call to Arms from the musical Les Misérables, about a Parisian uprising against a corrupt monarchy. We're joined now by NPR's Emily Feng in Beijing. Thanks so much for being with us, Emily.
Thanks, Scott.
That song doesn't have a subtle message. Why is Dr. Li's death resonating with so many people and so fiercely?
People need a hero. Imagine hundreds of millions of people. They've been isolated in their homes for the last 2 weeks. They're terrified that this invisible virus is going to kill them or their loved ones. And they're reading news every day that people are dying for want of care. Also, my reporting and reporting from many others has shown that leaders in Wuhan, which is the city where the disease began, knew from scientists that the virus was highly contagious, it resembled SARS, and then they didn't do much until about 3 weeks later. So for a lot of people in China, Dr. Li represents this tragic everyman figure who was suppressed by Chinese leaders. He also seemed like a really nice guy. Here's an interview a Chinese online outlet did with Li's mother the day he died. She's saying, Li's father and I had pneumonia, but we just recovered. Tragically, our son didn't make it. He was only 34. He had such potential and talent. He could never tell a lie. The circumstances of Li's death have also really angered people. Initially, state media reported that his heart had given out, and then the grief started pouring out online. State media then deleted their own articles, said, actually, no, wait, we've resuscitated him, he's on life support. Then they had to issue the reports when he actually died, when it was clear he wasn't going to make it. And Li leaves behind a 5-year-old son. His wife is expecting to give birth to their second child in June.
Emily, any response from the leaders of China? No apology?
They have not officially apologized. There are these state media obituaries that lionize Dr. Li as an upstanding and, this is key, loyal citizen. Authorities did say they are going to send the National Supervisory Commission, which is this infamous anti-corruption watchdog, to Wuhan to investigate why the doctor was reprimanded in the first place. But this outcry is a huge questioning of legitimacy of China's ruling Communist Party. It's one of the biggest challenges that they're facing in the last year, and they've actually had a really rough year, what with the protests in Hong Kong going on, this trade war with the U.S. And so the Communist Party here is responding with a very familiar tool, and that is massive censorship. When Dr. Li died, there were millions of posts going up, demanding freedom of speech, demanding answers. Those were taken down within hours. And I've spoken to several people on the record whose social media accounts were suddenly sealed off this week because they had posted or shared articles critical of how the outbreak was being handled. They're among tens of thousands that have been suddenly cut off.
And Emily, what's the latest reported from Wuhan? Any sign the outbreak might soon be contained?
No, the number of cases is going up, though the rate is slowing down. There are a lot of concerns, though, that this is because there's such limited capacity to treat people, and there are questions as to how many healthcare workers like Dr. Li were infected.
NPR's Emily Fang in Beijing, thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott.
And that's Up First for Saturday, February 8th, 2020. I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro.
And I'm Scott Simon. Up First is back Monday with news to start your day. And you can follow us on social media. We're at Up First on Twitter.
The news, it just keeps on going even after this podcast ends. What can you do for that?
We've got radio shows. Listen to Weekend Edition Saturday and Sunday. Find it on your NPR station at stations.npr.org.
Oscar season, and we don't want you to show up on the red carpet unprepared. That's why NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour is here to help you sort through the nominees and separate the best from the rest. Listen now, and we might even help you dominate your Oscars pool.